across the Pacifica network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, August 7, 2003. I'm Deepa Fernandez. A Texas execution is stayed hours before the mentally retarded prisoner was scheduled to die. As one of the Portland Seven, Maher Hawash, pleads guilty to providing services to the Taliban, there are two further challenges from the other six to the Patriot Act that could make all evidence against them inadmissible in court. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. 10 people were killed and at least 50 injured as a bomb blew up in Baghdad, apparently targeting the Jordanian embassy. Ahmed Arawi reports from Baghdad.
A car with high explosives exploded, causing the destruction of many other cars parked near the embassy. Some eyewitnesses say that Iraqis who tried to enter the embassy after the explosion were fired at from inside the embassy. Other Iraqis felt angry and destroyed some of the private properties of the embassy. Jordan's information minister, Nabil Sharif, denounced the attack, describing it as a terrorist and cowardly act. Some political analysts claim that Jordan's decision in giving refuge to Saddam Hussein's two daughters is the reason behind this attack. Nevertheless, no one has yet claimed responsibility. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ahmed Arawi in Baghdad.
Hollywood actor Arnold Schwarzenegger has formally announced his bid to become California's next governor, forcing Democrats to weigh the wow factor. Mitch Jeserich reports from San Francisco.
While former Mr. Universe Arnold Schwarzenegger receives plenty of free publicity in his campaign, over 200 people are considering a run in the recall of Governor Gray Davis as well. Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante announced he'll run and is the first Democrat to break ranks. Lieutenant Governor Bustamante became the first Latino in 1998 to hold a constitutional statewide office. Progressives will now have quite a few choices on the recall ballot come October 7th, though two popular progressives, columnist Arianna Huffington and former Green Party gubernatorial candidate Peter Camejo, could split the progressive third-party vote. Governor Davis calls the recall a right-wing coup attempt. White House officials have not indicated an opinion on the recall, but an email sent by Republican PR strategists with connections to the White House encourages political activists to form a women's group in favor of the recall. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jeserich.
The Internal Revenue Service is gearing up to require low-income taxpayers to prove they deserve the earned income tax credit, while high-income earners and corporations can breathe easily. Robert Flaxman has this report from D.C.
The EITC is a reduction in the amount of tax an individual owes, created to give a tax break to low-income workers with children. In 2002, the IRS returned about $32 billion in EITC payments to about 19 million filers. Keith Ashdown, Vice President of Policy at Taxpayers for Common Sense, says that the Bush administration does not require pre-certification of records for wealthy or big business taxpayers as they plan to for earned income tax credit filers.
It's basically saying, hey, we'll go after working Americans and we're going to let corporate America get off scot-free because they're not enforcing the rules that are targeted toward the mega-rich in America.
Even before the new program for proof of eligibility was announced in June, EITC filers were already audited at double the rate of other taxpayers, and the IRS plans to increase initial investigations of eligibility from the 2004 number of 25,000 to prospectively 5 million taxpayers by 2006. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Robert Flaxman.
The New York City Police Department must stop creating dossiers on political activists, according to a federal judge. Jackson Allers has this report from WBAI in New York.
Manhattan federal judge Charles Haight ruled to, quote, modify New York Police Department spy rules to the framework of a court order. This makes the New York Police Department accountable if they break their own surveillance rules. The NYPD was caught by civil liberties groups for illegally collecting political dossiers on protesters who rallied in New York City for the February 15th global protests against the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. In March, the same federal judge gutted the NYPD's surveillance guidelines because of, quote, fundamental changes in the threats to public security, adopting instead the FBI surveillance guidelines issued by Attorney General John Ashcroft last year. Groups like the New York Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Constitutional Rights claim this is a victory for what they say is a concerted effort to stifle dissent. New York City officials are due to release an official statement today. From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City, I'm Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
Another civil rights group is calling for further investigation into the hanging death of a black man in a rural Florida town. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference issued a unanimous statement at their convention in Memphis, Tennessee this week, saying, historically in the South, inquests regarding the hangings of African-American males have resulted in findings of suicide. 32-year-old Ferraris Ray Golden was found hanging from a tree in his grandmother's yard in Belleglade, Florida, about an hour from West Palm Beach. Last week, a judge ruled the death a suicide. Others charged the investigation was sloppy and that it was more likely a lynching initiated by the rumor that Golden was dating a white woman. Other organizations, including the NAACP and the Federal Commission on Civil Rights, are calling for a broader and independent investigation. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Yesterday in Oregon, Maher Hawash, one of the so-called Portland Seven, pled guilty to charges of trying to provide services to the Taliban. In exchange for his testimony against the other six defendants in the case, the federal government will drop the other charges against Hawash. Neither the government nor Hawash's lawyers will reveal what his motivation was for pleading guilty, and refuse to give details about what evidence his testimony will contain. The deal was approved by John Ashcroft, and some are asking why the government would settle for a sentence which could end up being as short as 7 years for one of the first people to be jailed for supporting terrorists since 9/11. The answer may lie in a lawsuit filed last week by the Portland Seven, which challenges the Patriot Act and potentially could make all evidence gathered under the act inadmissible in court. Andrew Stelzer has more on these developments and two other challenges to the Patriot Act that have recently come together in Oregon.
This is the first time in my life that I have felt frightened for speaking out.
Kathleen Sadat is a longtime Portland community activist.
I think a part of why we're all so concerned, not just about the Patriot Act, but about the soup we find ourselves in, is that many of us have lived through the Vietnam era, the Iran-Contras, Watergate, Kent State, on and on. So we already have a good foundation in how it is that our government can manipulate and deceive us.
Sadat was one of several speakers at Portland State University, where over 150 people attended a forum on the USA Patriot Act and the infringements it makes on American civil liberties. In response to citizen outrage, seven local government bodies in Oregon have passed resolutions against the Patriot Act and the powers it grants to the government, including the ability to spy on citizens, to enter and search people's homes without telling them, to detain suspects indefinitely with no explanation, and to keep evidence against suspects secret.
Information about how government is using these new powers to search and to spy on us is now almost impossible to obtain.
Stuart Kaplan works with the American Civil Liberties Union. Last week, the Oregon ACLU filed two lawsuits. In the first, the Islamic Center of Portland, along with five other Muslim community centers in Michigan, are seeking an injunction against the Patriot Act based on Section 215. Kaplan says that because of the information gathering powers of Section 215, people may be scared to seek needed assistance.
And these are all Muslim organizations, and they exist in order to help people to find jobs, to get medical cares. And one of the things that these organizations are very concerned about is that they keep personal records on people necessarily. And all these organizations have said to their clients, this is confidential, and now Section 215 of the Patriot Act turns that around.
The ACLU has also filed a suit on behalf of the defendants known as the Portland Seven, which challenges the constitutionality of the Patriot Act as a whole. But the problem for both lawsuits, says Kaplan, is that lawyers can't prove the government gathered evidence illegally unless they have access to the evidence in question. And the Patriot Act allows the government to keep all of their evidence secret.
The information about that is not very thorough because of the secrecy.
Earl Blumenauer was one of three Oregon congressmen who voted against the Patriot Act in October of 2001. He says that Congress made a mistake they are just now waking up to.
We are seeing a trend where I think there are a variety of people in Congress who are having second thoughts.
One of those who seems to have had a change of heart is Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, who recently introduced legislation titled the Protecting the Rights of Individuals Act. Instead of repealing the Patriot Act, it attempts to replace sections of the act with language that requires the FBI and others to present more proof and evidence of probable cause to a judge before they can collect information. Senate Bill 1552 has a long way to go, but in Oregon at least, it seems to have congressional support from politicians like Blumenauer who see the Patriot Act as a grave mistake for America.
It was, sadly, part and parcel of a series of events we've seen over the course of the last 2 years that undermines the credibility of our country.
For Free Speech Radio News from Portland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
A Fifth Circuit court in Texas last night stayed the execution of a mentally retarded man hours before his scheduled death. Just before 9 p.m. Central Time, José Alfredo Rivera became the 13th such prisoner in the state to have his life spared under a Supreme Court decision that such executions are cruel. Eric Thompson reports from Huntsville, Texas.
Just after 5 p.m. Wednesday evening at the Huntsville Walls Unit, also known as the Texas Death House, José Alfredo Rivera ate his last meal and prepared for his execution scheduled for 6 p.m. While Rivera waited to be escorted to the death chamber outside the Huntsville prison walls, a contingent of death penalty opponents gathered, holding candles and waving signs which read, "Abolish the death penalty." Najeri Shakur was one of those compelled to make the 100-mile journey from Houston to Huntsville to protest Rivera's execution.
But more than humane, what about the justice? How can you try somebody who has a very low IQ? How can you try somebody? How can you put them on the gurney when somebody says, "I did this thing, and I pointed at this guy because he was too slow to defend himself"?
Rivera was sentenced to die for the 1993 killing of 3-year-old Daniel Luis Blanco. Blanco was found floating in a pond. Autopsy reports revealed the 3-year-old was sexually assaulted and strangled by the elastic of his underwear. While many Texas death row inmates make claims of innocence, Rivera confessed to the murder in 1993, but Texas has already convicted another person. Veronica Zavala was an accessory to the murder. In a separate trial related to Blanco's murder, she was sentenced to life in prison. Court-appointed attorney David Sergi handled portions of Rivera's post-conviction remedies.
Zavala now, her position has been since 4 or 5 years ago. He didn't do a darn thing. She did it all herself. And she's responsible, solely. He wasn't even there.
Evidence collected by the Texas Defender Service, a nonprofit law firm that represents death row inmates, shows it may have been Rivera's serious mental impairment that led him to originally confess to a crime he may not have committed. Fort Worth-based psychologist Richard Garnett met with Rivera and has since examined his school records. Garnett says there are enough questions raised to suggest possibility of mental retardation and argued Rivera's execution should be halted until a more thorough review of his social history is done.
Had a terrible record in school, repeating various grades, being placed in special education, but skirting the edge with D's and F's even in special education classes. Prison records also indicated questions about whether or not he was capable of functioning at a normal level. And I think characterized him as having many of the symptoms of mental retardation, although that diagnostic label was not assigned.
Under the Supreme Court's 2002 decision in Atkins v. Virginia, this type of compelling evidence can now be used to back claims that execution of people like Rivera is unconstitutional. It was with this in mind that the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals halted Rivera's scheduled death for a minimum of 30 days. Rivera's legal team scrambled through last-minute effort to halt the execution of their mentally challenged client, attorney David Sergi.
It's unconstitutional to execute the mentally retarded, and it appears that it should apply to Mr. Rivera. What's, I think, more important here is the fact that the man is actually innocent and that the man confessed falsely. And if you read Atkins, Justice O'Connor, who's not a flaming liberal, who's rather conservative, actually talks about the fact that mentally retarded people will falsely confess.
Since the Atkins decision last year, Texas has had 18 executions halted based on mental retardation claims. 13 stays were handed down under warrant of death. The others came in post-conviction appeals. Texas is next scheduled to execute Mark Robertson on August 20th. Reporting from Huntsville, Texas, with assistance from Renee Feltz, I'm Eric S. Thompson for Free Speech Radio News.
In a telling blow to workers and trade unions in India, the Supreme Court of India has banned all strikes by government employees. The decision comes after nearly 200,000 government employees in the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu were sacked after they went on strike. When the sacked workers approached India's highest court seeking redress, the court ordered their reinstatement, but only on the condition that they apologize and agree not to participate in any further strikes. Trade unions call this a direct attack on the fundamental rights of collective bargaining. FSRN correspondent Binu Alex has more from India.
Justice M.P. Shah is a judge known for his judgments on consumer rights. But when his bench delivered a judgment yesterday that no government employee has the right to strike, it created panic among millions of government employees. More panicked are the trade unions. They say protests through strike are the only way in a democracy against unjust employers. Ashim Roy is associated with New Trade Union Initiative.
What is the basic rights of a worker in a democratic society? If the Supreme Court can interpret law and constitution in the manner that it has done so, then it shows that our law and our constitution has not adequately codified the rights of the workers. And I think a campaign and a movement for codifying them in a systematic fashion will begin with this kind of judgment.
The apex court has ruled that the strike caused disruption to other citizens and the economy. The government figures say that one day's general strike is equivalent to $500 million for the Indian state. There is a widespread allegation that the employees regularly impose strikes across the country to fulfill their demands. The ruling is in the light of a major strike in the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu. The government sacked nearly 200,000 employees, but the Supreme Court intervened and the government reinstated almost all on the pledge that they will not participate in future strikes. Pinarayi Vijayan is the leader of Communist Party in South Indian state of Kerala.
It is a myth that such rulings can end the means to protest. In fact, it will only intensify and bounce back stronger.
Trade unions have expressed their shock and have started agitations against the ruling. Gurudas Gupta is a trade union leader from West Bengal, one of the two communist-ruled states in India.
We shall go to the people, organize the workers, and do whatever is possible to defend our right to strike.
The ruling stated that if there was a denial of justice to some extent to the government employees, they had to resort to the machinery provided under the different statutory position for redressal of their grievances. It emphasized that the government employees have no fundamental legal, moral, or equitable right to go on strike. Again, Ashim Roy of the New Trade Union Initiative.
But Supreme Court has no right to decide, has no prerogative to decide that we don't have a moral right. A moral right is what people decide. Supreme Court has no moral right to decide such a moral question.
This Wednesday's ruling also said that no political party or organization can claim a right to paralyze the economic and industrial activities of a state or the nation. Legal experts like Prashant Bhushan see this as part of the globalization process.
This judgment seems to carry on a trend which seems to have started in the years of liberalization or globalization, which is to gradually curtail the rights of workers and leave them to the mercy of a market economy.
Collective bargaining is not collective paralyzing. This is what the judgment meant. The government has kept itself guarded on the judgment, choosing not to comment. But the trade union leaders are already on the streets and are planning to file a review petition. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
During a luncheon in New Hampshire yesterday, Senator John Edwards handed out a 60-page booklet of his policy proposal before members of the National Education Association. Edwards discussed his plan to pay teachers more if they teach in disadvantaged communities and to provide a free year of college in a state school in return for community service. This comes as a growing trend is being documented around the country where school counselors and teachers in disadvantaged communities are actively pushing low-performing students out of school to bolster their school's overall performance under the federal No Child Left Behind Act. Simba Russo has more.
In public high schools around the country, growing numbers of students are being encouraged to leave high school. Not for bad behavior, but because administrators think that they will fail standardized tests. Such students are not considered dropouts because it would give the public school system a bad rep. Rather, they are called pushouts. In April, the Houston Chronicle reported that city schools failed to report thousands of dropouts because employees wanted to collect a bonus for high accountability ratings.
The system in many cases has really worked against them.
Jill Chaifez, executive director for Advocates for Children in New York, is one of several organizations filing suit against the Department of Education. According to a study recently released by the organization, students are actually being pushed out of high schools before the age of 17 while never receiving a GED. New York City law allows a student till the age of 21 to attend high school. Under federal law, a student can be discharged without diploma if that student moves from one district to another or when a student voluntarily leaves school. And in a system of 1.1 million students with tens of thousands discharged every year, Chaifez believes that the number of pushouts is actually higher because counselors are providing the wrong information.
And then when we started to talk to young people, they basically said things like they came to school and their program cards had been changed and been told that their only possibility was going to a GED program. Many at-risk kids, including English language learner kids, for example, were told things like, look, there's no way you're going to pass the English Regents, so there's no reason for you to stay in school. Your best bet, for example, is the GED, so why don't you go there?
The No Child Left Behind law was the centerpiece of President Bush's education policy. An emphasis on high-stakes testing was intended to raise standards and improve accountability, but has also created a great deal of pressure on teachers and students. Both complain that some schools are winnowing out their weakest students to improve test averages.
Through the year 2008, states will have to pay somewhere between about $2 billion and over $5 billion just to pay for the testing provisions alone.
Daniel Kaufman, spokesperson for the National Education Association, is in the process of filing suit against the No Child Left Behind Act. According to the law, states are required to provide funding for the mandates imposed by the federal government, which causes cutbacks in already slim state resources, particularly in this current economy.
There are a number of states around the country that have been complaining to Washington and saying, look, you're requiring us to pay for new testing provisions, for closing down schools in some cases, for retraining teachers and paraprofessionals, and yet you're not willing to give us the resources we need to make it happen.
Critics add that pushing students out provides a quick solution for schools as it allows the numbers of success stories to override the existing problems and also to comply with the mandates of the federal government.
In terms of where we're actually investing our money is the criminal justice system. If you look at, for the city of New York, for example, Department of Juvenile Justice is spending on operation costs, spending over $100,000 a year to lock up a kid. Look at how much money we spend on a child in the public school system per year. Average is $10,000, and of course, if you go to, you know, low-income communities of color, actually you end up seeing less spending.
Kate Reed, director of the Prison Moratorium Project, believes that the system has failed with its emphasis on incarceration expansion rather than adequate educational resources. She believes that students who are pushed out end up in juvenile detention since that is where the funding goes.
Education funding has been cut by hundreds of millions of dollars. Where is a young person supposed to turn to in this society?
For now, it seems the National Education Association and others will use this as a lobbying tool against Republicans in the next presidential elections. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Simba Rousseau in New York.
Residents of the Pine Ridge Reservation's Wounded Knee community are upset over a Wounded Knee Massacre Museum that recently opened in Wall, South Dakota. Non-native and Colorado resident Steve Wyant says his purpose for building the narrative museum about the Wounded Knee Massacre was purely out of respect for the Lakota people. But as Jim Kent discovered, the residents of Wounded Knee don't consider the museum to be a symbol of respect for their culture.
All right, gather around, folks, and feast your eyes on this little box.
The tiny town of Wall is known for its world-famous drugstore, its free ice water, and just about any other gimmick that would draw the average tourist off Interstate 90 at South Dakota's Exit 110. In short, Wall, located next to the Badlands National Park, and 50 miles away from the nearest city, is a tourist mecca that rivals any in the country. It's also the last place that residents of the Pine Ridge Reservation community of Wounded Knee want one of the most tragic events of their history to be on display.
We see it as another, to use the strong word, exploiting our history. And when we say history, that includes our culture, our customs, traditions, religion, everything.
Wounded Knee resident Phyllis Hollowhorn says non-native Steve Wyant is using the tragedy of the Wounded Knee Massacre to profit from. Even though it's been more than a century since 300 unarmed Lakota men, women, and children were cut down along the banks of Wounded Knee Creek by members of the 7th Cavalry, the memory of the tragedy of December 29, 1890 still lives inside most Lakota people. Because of this, consultation for any project concerning the massacre is essential. And consultation is the one thing that Steve Wyant failed to pursue before starting his museum, even though Wounded Knee Community President Carl Brokenleg advised him of its necessity.
I even told him, I said, maybe you should go house to house, talk to everybody. He kind of didn't want to go along with that, you know. But he said he was going to, but yet I knew he wasn't going to. Made it look like he was too busy to go house to house. Not only here in Wounded Knee housing, there's other places that he has to go to talk to people that are descendants. And I don't think he wants to do that.
Brokenleg's advice seems to have fallen on deaf ears, as indicated by Wyant's response to the question, who supports his museum project?
The Wounded Knee community, are the people down there aware of this? Have you touched base with anybody down there?
Oh, yeah.
And if so, who?
Pardon me?
And if so, who?
Many. Many people down there. Carl is the president down there, Carl Brokenleg, but he's somewhat supportive.
For his part, Wyant insists that he has one primary goal in opening the Wounded Knee Massacre Museum.
To educate people and to develop a commercially capitalistic system, a business that can generate income.
According to United States Holocaust Memorial Museum spokesman Andrew Hollinger, hundreds of Holocaust survivors and their families were consulted over a 13-year period prior to that museum opening its doors in 1993.
We have to be sensitive to the people that we are memorializing. So it's just hard to imagine how the museum could even exist if we didn't have the support of survivors and their families.
Wyant says he plans to give the museum to the Wounded Knee community if it turns a profit. If not, he may turn it into a Pine Ridge Reservation tourism office. Wyant didn't say whether he intends to get approval from tribal officials before embarking on that venture. Either way, Wyant, who describes himself as a businessman, is also planning to build a museum dedicated to the American bison. Phyllis Hollowhorn says members of the Wounded Knee community are in the process of having the Wounded Knee name copyrighted to protect it from anyone else, like Wyant, who might want to show respect for the Lakota culture.
We see him as exploiting, using our ancestors that were killed here.
Soon to be world-famous breakthrough known as Wall Drug Snake Oil Cologne. Fellas,
for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent in Wall, South Dakota.
It's proven indispensable as a cleaning agent.
And this news comes as we go to broadcast. More scandal today for the Catholic Church as a confidential Vatican document drafted more than 40 years ago became public. The document set out a policy that demanded total secrecy in cases of sex abuse by priests and said that anyone who spoke out about sexual abuse could be kicked out of the church. The document deals with what it calls the, quote, worst crime of sexual assault committed by a priest or attempted by him with youths of either sex or with brute animals, end quote. The document instructed bishops to pursue such cases, quote, in the most secretive way, restrained by perpetual silence under the penalty of excommunication, end quote. Church records indicate that the document was the basis of the church's sex abuse policy until U.S. bishops drafted a new policy last year. U.S. bishops say that at least 400 priests have been dismissed over sex abuse charges since the new policy was written 1 year ago. This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.